From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. It started in 2008 as a little-known cryptocurrency. Now it's a household name, Bitcoin. When it first came out, it was worth pennies. Now it's valued at around $17,000 per coin. But it's not actually a coin, not even a certificate. It exists only in the digital world. But people are mortgaging their houses to buy Bitcoin. Investors are adding it to their portfolios. Should they? Some say there's a Bitcoin bubble and it's bound to burst. This hour, On Point, the buzz around Bitcoin. You can join us on air or online. Do you have Bitcoin? Are you thinking about getting it? Talk to us first. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. So here's the situation. Last week, Bloomberg Technology reported that Bitcoin is hitting record highs.
Bitcoin soars past $13,000 for the first time. The largest cryptocurrency by market value was selling for less than $1,000 at the start of the year. In recent days, several exchanges have come out with news on offering Bitcoin futures.
And the value of Bitcoin has only increased since then. It hit a record high yesterday and was quoted at more than $17,000 on the Bitstamp exchange. Eric Feynman, now 19, began investing in Bitcoin when he was 12. He's made millions. Last week, he told the Today Show he has confidence in the future of the cryptocurrency.
I have 401 Bitcoins and I have, you know, $3 million+ in Bitcoin. Obviously, a lot of haters out there that want to make money betting against it. Even if everyone bets against Bitcoin on the market, I still think Bitcoin will be immensely successful.
Well, a lot of people are counting on it. During a recent interview with Bloomberg, Joseph Borg, the Alabama Securities Commission director, said he has seen people take out mortgages to buy Bitcoin.
This is not something a guy who's making $100,000 a year, who's got a mortgage and two kids in college, ought to be investing.
Joe, there's worse reports. We've had reports that people are using their credit card to buy Bitcoins.
Oh, we've seen mortgages being taken out to buy Bitcoins.
You have?
What? Yes.
Come on.
Sure. People borrow money. Look,
you're saying people take equity lines out?
Yeah.
To buy?
Sure.
Holy smokes.
Well, joining us now from Berkeley, California is Nathaniel Popper. He covers finance and technology for the New York Times, and he's the author of Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. Nathaniel, thanks so much for being with us once again.
Thank you for having me.
That is really grabs your attention, doesn't it, that exchange there? And you call them misfits and millionaires. Which are the misfits and which are the millionaires?
The line between them is sometimes very blurry. Often, certainly today, a lot of those misfits have turned into millionaires or in some cases, billionaires.
They could be misfits tomorrow.
Yeah, they could go back in the other direction. I mean, right, part of what you have to remember at a moment like this, where the price of Bitcoin is so high, and Bitcoin has been through a lot of these runs before in its 8-year history. None, I think, quite like this, but they often do come down, and people have ended up in jail at all steps along the way, for a variety of reasons connected to this. But, I think both sides of this get at the degree to which this is a whether it works or not, it is a kind of revolutionary new technology.
It sure is. But it's a very unfamiliar technology to a lot of us, Nathaniel.
Yes.
I'm a novice, and a lot of our listeners are novices. I'm here to represent them. So let's start with a kind of Bitcoin for dummies, okay?
Of course.
One of the things that I am curious about is what distinguishes cryptocurrency transactions from what we know of as electronic banking. I mean, when I get paid, my employer sends a credit electronically to my bank account. When I make an automatic mortgage payment, my bank debits my account by that amount, sends a credit to whoever's holding the mortgage. Same for my telephone bill. If I want to give my son some money, I tell my bank to transfer X amount from my account to his account. None of those transactions involve checks, no physical currency, no gold, silver, nickel coins. It's virtual. So what distinguishes a cryptocurrency system like Bitcoin from what we already have?
Right. Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, some people refer to this as digital money. As you're pointing out, most money is already digital. You know, most money that exists in our economy only exists on a computer. There's nothing backing it up. There's no gold. So what makes Bitcoin different? It is digital money. But what makes it so different is the sort of network that it lives on. So your money, your paycheck, that exists on these bank ledgers that are kept by your bank and then backed up by the Federal Reserve. And that is very different than Bitcoin, which all of the Bitcoins in the world exist on a decentralized network that is somewhat like the internet, that the records for which are kept by these computers around the world. And so every single Bitcoin is represented on this ledger, which is known as the blockchain, which all these computers around the world are constantly updating. And the fact that there are all of these computers around the world doing it means that there is no company or no government in charge. And that's really the central new element to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, is that it's a system that exists with nobody in charge. I think probably the most familiar concept for most people is Wikipedia, which is this dictionary that, you know, a single dictionary that you can go look at the entries in it. But there's no company in charge. It's just a bunch of people around the world who are sort of voluntarily updating it. And Bitcoin is somewhat like that for money.
Okay, Nathaniel, but so that understands sort of that makes clear the process. But the key to value is scarcity. And what makes Bitcoin scarce? I mean, that's something else that considering that there is nothing to back it up, there are no banks, no governments, no gold reserves. Yeah. What makes Bitcoin scarce?
Well, so just like Wikipedia has these rules for how you can add to it and how you can edit it, Bitcoin has these rules, the Bitcoin software that everybody around the world is running, and that sort of sets the basic parameters of the system. And there are a whole bunch of complicated rules, how they're created, how they're moved around. One of the rules from the very beginning is that there would only ever be 21 million Bitcoin created. And they're parceled out very slowly and given to the computers that are helping to sort of maintain the network. But the idea is there's only going to be so many of them. And so, you know, somewhat like gold, you know, this is scarce, you know, that breeds a sense of value. And that was the idea behind that rule. Now, of course, the software can be changed. And the rules can be changed.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Nathaniel,
right.
who enforces that?
that's always the natural next question. But the way that Bitcoin works is the rules can only be changed if a majority of the people running the network agree to change the rules. And what we've seen over the first, 9 years, almost 10 years of Bitcoin, is that it's very hard to change the rules. And the people running it want to maintain these rules. They got invested because they care about the system. They care about the sort of rules behind the system. And so they don't want to change it. So, you know, people have tried to make much smaller changes to the software than, you know, increasing the number of Bitcoins. And it's been hard to, because you have to convince everybody. So it's sort of like a democracy. And if you do want to change the rules, and if you do want to increase the number of Bitcoins, if everybody agrees to that, maybe that's not a bad thing that happens at that point. But, you know, it seems like that's something that everybody in the system is pretty committed to.
Now, there is this concept of Bitcoin mining, suggesting that you can actually make a Bitcoin or find a Bitcoin or whatever the analogy is.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, Bitcoin mining is essentially the system that Bitcoins are distributed. On day one, when the Bitcoin software first sort of word to life and computers started joining in, there were no Bitcoins. Every 10 minutes or so, the rules of the software determined, somebody would win a sort of contest to get some of those Bitcoins. And the idea here is that you created an incentive for people to join the network and support the network. And then this process actually also has a second purpose, which is that these computers that are kind of racing to win Bitcoin are also serving as the accountants for the network. They're gathering up all the transactions that are coming in and keeping track of who has which Bitcoins. So you have this process that both gets people to get involved in Bitcoin and also gets people to keep the records for the whole thing. And it's kind of the central thing that makes Bitcoin mm-hmm. work. It's a little complicated when you get into the technical details of, you know, how you actually win those Bitcoins. But those are the kind of basic principles that have made Bitcoin work from the beginning.
No, it's complicated from beginning to end, Nath. I mean, you use the word bit. You've gone back and forth between saying Bitcoins and Bitcoin. Which is it? Is there a single Bitcoin denomination? Do you deal with fractions of a Bitcoin, or how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, you can divide a Bitcoin into as many parts as you want. I think right now the rules in the software say you can go out to, I believe it's 8 decimal places, and the smallest unit of a Bitcoin is currently referred to as a Satoshi. And Satoshi refers to Satoshi Nakamoto, the mysterious anonymous creator of Bitcoin. But you can buy any bit of a Bitcoin. There are bits. That's another denomination of a Bitcoin. And you so you don't just have to buy one Bitcoin.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gjelten. We're talking about Bitcoin. Whether it's a bubble about to burst or the investment of the future, you can join our conversation. Do you see cryptocurrency as the money of the future, or do you expect it all to come crashing down? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And some of our listeners are already weighing in. Larry thinks Bitcoin is the tulip mania of the 21st century. And if anyone remembers their history, they know that we went through a perhaps the most famous bubble of all time with tulips. Jim says, I bought $200 worth 4 years ago and cashed it in recently. I think it has the potential to increase, but I'm happy with where I cashed out. Rick says, I sell beer at stadiums and was paying up to 6% to credit card squares. Now with Bitcoin, you can pay me without any charges. Well, I'm not sure that you can buy beer with Bitcoin anytime soon, but there you go. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, well, he's been on with us all hours, Nathaniel Popper, who covers finance and technology for the New York Times, and via Skype from Newport Beach, California, is Campbell Harvey. He's a professor of finance at Fuqua School of Business at Duke University, where he teaches an innovation and crypto ventures course. Campbell, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be on the show, Tom.
Let me ask you first. I hate to sort of put two guests in potential opposition to each other, but you heard what Nathaniel was saying, sort of giving us the basics of the Bitcoin system in the first segment. Is there anything you want to contest or add to what Nathaniel was saying?
No, I thought it was an excellent summary. It's a very unique technology in that a computer program is kind of creating scarcity. Mm-hmm. And Nathaniel mentioned the 21 million limit on the creation of money. But it's also very expensive to actually produce one of these Bitcoin. So you have to invest in computing equipment, specialized equipment, and power to actually do it. So I think of it as algorithmic scarcity. And the analogy to gold is a good one.
Well, as we were saying, I mean, scarcity is a really important part of this. How confident are you that the scarcity of this asset, if it's to be called an asset, can be maintained? In other words, how vulnerable is the system to some kind of fraud, hacking, whatever that could sort of undermine the scarcity that is so important?
It is very secure. So the amount of computing power that is protecting the Bitcoin blockchain is enormous. And as Nathaniel said, to make any changes in the actual program is brutally difficult, as we've seen many times. So I'm very confident that it will remain 21 million Bitcoin. But this is important. Just because something's scarce doesn't mean that it has value. And that's one of the main issues with Bitcoin. How do we think of the value? So what if it's 21 million Bitcoin? What is determining the underlying value?
And are you sort of what's your position on this gamble? Do you think this is this makes sense? That is a good investment? Are you a skeptic? What's your general view of it?
So as an academic, I'm always a skeptic. So I think that this is a great idea. However, there's a lot of risk. And part of the risk is that we just don't know how to value something like this. If we're looking at, for example, a share of IBM, people can reasonably forecast the cash flows, the earnings. They know the risk of IBM. They come up with a valuation. Not everybody agrees, but it's a fairly narrow range of valuation. Now, compare that to something like Bitcoin, where there's no fundamentals, there's no cash flows, and the disagreement is intense, where many people believe the value is fundamentally zero, and other people believe the value of Bitcoin could be $1 million. So that sort of disagreement, in my opinion, induces a lot of volatility, makes it extremely difficult to actually come up with what is the value of Bitcoin.
But that's a fascinating question, isn't it? You know, I said at the beginning that I'm a novice, but actually a number of our listeners have invested in Bitcoin, and I want to go to at least one or two of them right now. First of all, Dan, he's calling from Austin, Texas. Dan, welcome to On Point. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Are you a Bitcoin investor or thinking about it?
Yeah, I've been, you know, just kind of a hobbyist investor for a little while. I saw it back in 2010, in fact, and decided to invest in silver, which was probably the most boneheaded thing I've ever done. But starting in 2013, about 2014, when it climbed back down from 1,000 the first time I got in, like I said, in a casual way, half a Bitcoin here, Bitcoin there. It ended up being far better than any of my other investments, my IRA or anything could possibly have done. I'm putting a Bitcoin down on a down payment for a house very soon, so I can't think of a better choice I could have made financially.
And what did you pay for it when you, let's say that Bitcoin you put down is a down payment, what did you pay for it? Or what rate did you pay?
I bought, you know, at different times. I'd say my average Bitcoin buy-in was probably $300 to $350.
Per Bitcoin unit, for full unit.
Right. Yeah. And that was something I wanted to bring up was, I mean, these, since it is divisible down to the 8th decimal point, there's really, I mean, the kind of, the scarcity talk is somewhat irrelevant since, I mean, really, even accounting for all the Bitcoins that have been lost over the years, we still have, something like 15 million billion units of them. So, yeah. I mean, it's not like you absolutely have to have an entire one for it to still be of value.
Nathaniel Popper, is Dan a misfit or a millionaire, to use your terms?
I don't know if he was a millionaire. Certainly from the way he was talking about acquiring, you know, half a Bitcoin here and one there, it sounds like he might be getting close. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think that's the thinking you hear from a lot of people. I mean, one of the things you want to tease apart right now is the fact that right now it looks like a very good investment. So if you got in at any point in the past, you have done very well on your Bitcoin. There were many spans of Bitcoin's history over which it didn't look like as good an investment. As Dan mentioned, it ran up to $1,000 in late 2013 and then sort of stumbled down to $250 over, 3 years and was really kind of bumbling along. I think a lot of people thought it had disappeared. One of the things I just want to add to your question about security is, and this is one of the reasons it stumbled along in the way that it did, the Bitcoin software and network itself has proven to be very secure, and that's, I think, what makes this enduring. But the things that we have built on top of it, and the sort of Bitcoin banks and exchanges and a lot of the services that people use to get Bitcoin, have proven to be much less secure. So, you know, when you get a dollar and you have it in a bank, if that dollar gets stolen, if the bank goes under, that's insured.
Right.
If your Bitcoin is stolen from your Bitcoin exchange or your Bitcoin wallet, you're not getting it back. And it's actually very hard to secure a Bitcoin. I mean, it involves a sort of password called a private key, and you have to secure that private key. And that sounds somewhat easy, but securing private keys actually turns out to be a very difficult problem, mm-hmm. and very vulnerable to hacking. So the system itself has been very secure, the network and the protocol, but you know, the personal act of holding Bitcoins is actually proven to be quite difficult, and a lot of those hackings have led to some of the downturns in prices that we've seen over time.
Right. Well, it seems that security and risk are the big issues here, and we're going to be getting to those. I want to go first to Bill, who is on the line from Farm River, Connecticut. Bill, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. So my first call-in was about the mining. I'd like to preface how I ask this. My working philosophy about humans is that we're only good at a couple things, and we're really bad at the things we think we're good at. So innovation is actually something humans are terrible at. And figuring out what the future is going to be, we're so bad at that we have the two expressions, 2020 hindsight and the other one, which I forgot, which you know. On the other hand, we're really good at two things. We're really good at playing games, and we're really good at thinking we're good at stuff. So what that means is that when I look at this whole thing about mining and how is Bitcoin made and what is the value of Bitcoin, we have this serious problem, which exists in every human endeavor. When only a few people understand how something really works,
right.
They're able to game the system mm-hmm. and win. And usually that means everybody else gets screwed.
Okay.
Or is run out of the game, or the game implodes.
You've raised some really good issues. You raised some good issues here, and let's just sort of zero in on this question of whether part of the value of Bitcoin is in fact the fact that people don't understand it, which means that the winners can game the system. I want to put that question to Mike Belchi. He's joining us now from Palo Alto, California. He's the co-founder and CEO of BitGo, which is a virtual cryptocurrency wallet provider. And as we've been throwing that term around, wallet is sort of where you keep your Bitcoins. It's a digital wallet. And Mike's company helps secure digital assets held by hedge funds, exchanges, trusts, broker deals, and other businesses. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So how about that question that we just heard, that part of sort of the reason Bitcoin is working the way it is because people don't understand it and some are able to game it for their own advantage?
Well, I think it's a great question. And I'll take a counter view to, I think, the tone that I heard there. Actually, and just a few minutes ago on the show, you were talking about, yeah, what is Bitcoin backed by?
Right.
And on one hand, people want to say it's backed by nothing, but it's actually backed by something which is stronger than anything we've ever seen in a monetary system before. And it's a little abstract, but when you think about it, it makes sense. And also gets back to this last question about gaming and rules and transparency. Bitcoin is backed by code. That is software.
By what, Mike?
By code, by software.
By code, right, okay.
And, you know, one thing that computers are very good at is faithfully executing repeated rules in the exact same manner on an ongoing basis. They never vary. They never deviate. So humans, however, we vary from our rules all the time. And history shows us that every monetary system that's ever been created eventually dies. Humans make mistakes. You know, somebody may be well-intentioned, maybe not, doesn't really matter, sooner or later gets in charge and has the ability to change the system in a way to the public's detriment. And eventually that system dies and another one is born. Well, with Bitcoin, we're backed by code. The code is written. The rules are readable. They're reviewable by anyone. So on one hand, the question here is like, well, wait, it's a game and only a few people understand it. But hold on. That code is very public, very well known, distributed worldwide, audited and reviewed by thousands of people. We've never had a monetary system that was that transparent before. Do you know what goes on inside of the Fed? Mm. I don't know what goes on inside of the Fed, mm-hmm. but is that a trustworthy system? Now, the Fed is also run by humans. And, you know, we're one election away from having a new guy put in charge of the Fed, right? There's only seven people on the board of the Fed, and they get to make those decisions. So anyway,
okay.
I think you could look at it pessimistically as though it's a game and that only a few people understand it. But I think when you actually tease apart that argument, you find that this is the most transparent system the world has ever seen. And it's run by somebody that monitors rules in a far more faithful manner than any system we've ever had run by humans.
Mike, I know you hadn't quite finished your point, your argument yet there, but I want to go to Campbell Harvey at Duke University, where he's a professor of finance. And Campbell, is anything that Mike said, do you want to challenge anything that Mike said as far as sort of the power and the strength of the Bitcoin system?
Yes and no. So I agree with Mike. This is very elegant. It's algorithmic. It's the value is the code. The point I was trying to make is it's really hard to put a particular number on the value of the code. So we can disagree over what that value actually is. And that makes it very difficult to figure out if Bitcoin at 17,000 is what it should be worth. I'm strongly of the belief that right now we are in the middle of a bubble. And we've seen bubbles before, and the tulip is an extreme example. But I think a more recent example is the internet bubble in the late 1990s, where there was a substantial correction. So I think that the difference between today and, let's say, a few years ago is consistent with this question. A few years ago, the people that were investing in Bitcoin believed in the technology. They understood to a large degree how blockchain actually worked. Today, we've got an enormous number of speculators piling into the market. We've got the main bank, Coinbase, having more customers than Schwab. People are piling into this. They're bandwagon investors, and there will be a correction.
Mike, do you acknowledge that there might very well be a correction here? And I assume that wouldn't necessarily discourage you.
Yeah, there will be ups and downs, corrections, whatever you want to call them. I do think there's a tremendous amount of retail customers that are coming in, not fully understanding exactly what the values are of Bitcoin and other currencies. So they're going to temporarily boost the price, and then that'll come back down. But I think for the folks that are in the industry, what we're excited about is the long-term prospects. And comparing Bitcoin to stocks is difficult because it's really a different type of asset. It's not like a stock. It's sort of like a money, sort of like an asset. It's sort of like gold. All of these things are alternative value systems. But just to give you some examples of the power of Bitcoin, if you're a resident of Argentina today and you're facing annual 100% year-over-year inflation, right? Trying to save for your kids' college means if you put $1,000 away now, next year you've got $500, and the year after that you've got $250, right? So what do the citizens of Argentina do? Well, of course, they don't use their system. Instead, they start using dollars and things like that. They need a system which preserves value. So Bitcoin is actually the first system that we've had that really can preserve value.
Well,
all other systems.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see about that. I mean, I'm sure a lot of Bitcoin investors are certainly hoping that is the case. Mike Belshi is co-founder and CEO of BitGo. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gjelten. We're talking about cryptocurrencies, the risks, the rewards, and the future. You can join our conversation. Do you think regulations should be put in place for cryptocurrency? Should the market just exist as it has been until now? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. So a couple of days ago, the Winklevoss twins, Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, spoke to Bloomberg. They are the co-founders of Gemini, a cryptocurrency exchange. Here's Tyler Winklevoss and why he thinks people should invest in Bitcoin.
We think that Bitcoin is like gold 2.0. So whatever the reasons, your reasons for investing in gold, whether it's scarce, durability, portability, fungibility, we think that Bitcoin matches or beats gold across the board in all of those categories. It's actually not scarce. It's fixed. You can send it around like you send an email. It's a lot harder to do that with bars of gold.
And meanwhile, the real-life wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort, told CNN last week that while there's a lot of excitement about Bitcoin right now, the market is bound to come crashing down.
You have this skyrocketing demand, very little supply, but then at a certain point, something will happen. There'll be either regulation will pass, something will go wrong, and all of a sudden the sentiment will change, and it is going to drop so hard and fast.
And Joe Grunfest, a professor at Stanford Law School and a former SEC commissioner, expressed his concerns about the unregulated nature of Bitcoin. This was also last week on CNBC.
From my perspective, we're still in the Wild West phase over here. And the technology is several steps ahead of where the regulatory infrastructure is. I'm not entirely persuaded that all of the regulators really understand everything that's happening in this market.
Okay, a lot of questions here. My guests today are Nathaniel Popper, who covers finance and technology for the New York Times, and via Skype, Campbell Harvey, professor of finance at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. And Campbell, first to you. One of your colleagues, or at least another professor at Duke by the name of Lawrence Baxter, wrote this recently, actually this week. At the first serious and likely coordinated move by governments to regulate or bank the digital currency, Bitcoin's price will crash to zero, panicked owners will rush to exit, and the bubble will burst. Bitcoin futures and options may just as well be based on pixies and fairies. That's a pretty pessimistic outlook for the Bitcoin business. What do you make of that argument?
So obviously, I don't agree with that. So I did say I believe that there is kind of bubble-like behavior right now, and there could be a very substantial correction. Indeed, I think it's prudent for somebody investing in Bitcoin to be prepared to lose 90% of their investment. So going in, you need to be able to understand there's a possibility it could drop by, let's say, 50 to 90%. But I think this idea of regulation, one thing is that Bitcoin is this international currency. There's no central bank that's controlling it. There are some countries that have already banned Bitcoin, but if one country bans it, it just goes offshore. The more important point is that the future is actually very easy to forecast, that we will be in a world of cryptocurrencies. All currencies will be cryptocurrencies. And right now, we see the first wave with Bitcoin and Ethereum and things like that. But more realistically, it doesn't make any sense to have a paper currency for any country. That will be a relic in the future. And the Federal Reserve and all other central banks will issue their own cryptocurrencies. And when they do that, then there could be some real competition and pressure in terms of the regulatory environment that threatens the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Okay, here's a question that I want you, Campbell, and you also, Nathaniel, to answer quickly. Article just appeared on Bloomberg last night saying that Bitcoin trading has expanded faster this year in emerging markets than in developed ones, and quickest of all in places where authorities have tried to crack down. After all, avoiding bank and government oversight and sidestepping the eroding effects of inflation was what this mysterious person, Nakamoto, had in mind when he, she, or they created Bitcoin in 2008. First, Campbell, to what extent is the success of Bitcoin precisely this kind of libertarian, anti-government quality to it? And once governments start to, like, take more notice of it, does that undermine sort of faith and interest in the system?
So it is true what you say, that initially it was very very much founded by libertarians. But I think the group of people that really understand the blockchain technology expanded, and especially the economists, just seeing the value of having transactions with almost no transactions cost. That makes everything more efficient. It makes everybody better off to have a system like that that's immediate, that you take a lot of middle people out of the equation. It is also true that there are many emerging markets that are in distress, that they can't trust their own currency. It's hard to get U.S. dollars. So this is very attractive. Now, I always thought that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies would have the best growth in emerging markets, where there was a real need for an alternative currency. But that really didn't play out because of the speculative demand in the U.S. So that's where the price appreciation is being driven.
And Nathaniel Popper, one of the places where there's a lot of interest in Bitcoin, not surprisingly, is in Venezuela, where their currency loses a good part of its value every day. What do you make of Venezuela's interest, even the Venezuelan government's interest in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies generally?
Yeah, I mean, as Campbell noted, I mean, people who kind of really believe in this technology have thought that it had the most potential in places like Venezuela and Zimbabwe. I mean, in writing my book, I spent a bunch of time in Argentina, where I saw ordinary people using this to kind of escape inflation or trying to escape inflation. And, you know, as an American, it's hard to understand what it's like to live in a place where you don't trust the local currency and where it's hard to get a bank account. And so this does look more plausible in a place like that, where even just having your money in the local currency is very risky.
Yeah.
So in the United States, you know, keeping your money in the dollar is not a terribly risky endeavor, and changing it into Bitcoin creates a lot more risk. But for a Venezuelan, it's just a question of which risks you're going to take. Now, I think, you know, this is, though, you know, you asked about the sort of libertarian anti-government aspect of it. You know, whether or not the people buying it have an anti-government bent, certainly I think one of the central attractions to this, and what makes this so different than other investments you can make, is that there's nobody in charge, and that literally anybody in the world can access it. Mm-hmm. And that you have to recognize, whether you think governments are good or bad, when you have something that is available anywhere, that comes with a certain power, and I think that is one of the central attractions of Bitcoin, is that anybody anywhere in the world can get at it. And so you've seen over the last year, you know, in China a year ago, China was where people bought and sold Bitcoin. It was where most of the Bitcoin trading was happening. Earlier this year, the Chinese government cracked down, and I think everybody thought it was going to crash the market. And one of the most interesting things that's happened this year is that all these other countries stepped in. Mm-hmm. So people in Japan and Korea have just flooded into this market. And so the way that it can just kind of like move around borders is one of the most fascinating things. And you know, in a place like Venezuela or Zimbabwe, where you've also seen a lot of interest this year. It's kind of, you know, that I think was the early promise of it, was that it would be an alternative for people who really didn't trust their government, because I think in the United States, most people do.
Right. And Kyle, who's one of our listeners, has an interesting point to make in this regard. I believe Kyle is on the line from Austin, Texas. Kyle, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I think the main thing that we need to take from this is a community-based and community-driven, all due to the 2008 crash, where a market is controlled by a handful of people, when people who understand blockchain and obviously Satoshi Nakamoto, whenever they came up with this idea, and it was because it could give more power to bigger, larger community. So speculation to me is driven by the larger banks right now trying to get in, and a lot of people who don't understand the blockchain. But no matter what happens, blockchain isn't going anywhere. It's unhackable. The bubble can't really be compared to tulips, in my opinion, nor the dot-coms. But even if it could be, dot-coms, they did survive. Only the top ones did survive. And I don't think Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin is going anywhere because of that. When it comes to lower class, less fees, bank charges, bank congestion, bank manipulation, I don't see really an alternative that's any better.
Yeah. You mentioned Ethereum, which is, there are, we should point out, various cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is just one. I want Campbell to weigh in on that. But before you do, Campbell, let's hear from Joel, who's on the line from Johnson City, Tennessee. Joel, you have called On Point. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Great conversation. I'll be quick. I want to tease out a little more definition about the idea of a bubble. Definitionally, Bitcoin and crypto markets seem to be in a bubble. But if you think about some of the other bubbles you guys talked about, like the dot-com bubble, it's a new market. So we know there's value to be had, but we don't know what is valuable, which you guys have talked about. So yes, there was a correction, but there were still business, multi-billion dollar businesses built during the dot-com bubble that are successful today. If this happens to cryptocurrencies, my point is Bitcoin might not even fail or fall. It could be Litecoin or Ethereum or Ripple or any of the hundreds other ones. There's still a lot of value in the market. We just are having a hard time to figure out what it is. And even if there's a bubble going on, I don't think it'll completely destroy the crypto world. I'll take my answer off air.
I appreciate that. Well, Joel, Kyle made a similar point that even if there is a correction or a, or somewhat of a collapse, it doesn't mean necessarily the end of Bitcoin. And that's a point you were making, Campbell Harvey, that, you know, in fact, the with the rapid rise in the value of Bitcoin, we can assume that there will be corrections and perhaps even a calamitous fall. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, that it's out, that it doesn't have a future. But what are... Are there some assumptions in this system that the whole thing is based on? And if those assumptions prove wrong, are there premises here behind this system that, you know, whose viability has not yet been firmly established? You mentioned risks. What are that? What are those kind of institutional systemic risks that we should be aware of?
So there are many different risks. So let me review a few of them. The first is that it's really difficult to come up with some sort of valuation, and the volatility is intense. So one of the questions was, oh, well, we had this crash in 2008 and all of the shenanigans that went on, the bailouts and stuff like that. Let me just remind the listeners of your show that during that crash, we had the second worst day in the history of the S&P 500. On October 15th, 2008, the second worst day since 1945. Bitcoin, since 2011, has had 65 days that are worse than that disastrous day in October 2008. So on one level, it's very volatile investment. A bubble doesn't mean that you go to zero. And the dot-com is an example of not going to zero. Are there risks in the system? Yes. And one risk is, Nathaniel pointed out, that it's very difficult to change the code. That is an advantage and a disadvantage. Because for Bitcoin to grow, to evolve, there needs to be some changes. And we're not talking about the 21 million limit in terms of the coin creation, but other changes to make it more general. It's very difficult to do. The regulatory environment is another challenge, and the competition potentially from central banks. Mm-hmm. All of those are challenges that create risk going on in the future. If there is a major correction, I think, depending upon the size of the correction, that a lot of people that actually understand this technology will come in and buy.
Okay.
And we'll lose the bandwagon investors.
Okay, we're almost out of time. I want to get one more caller in. Shotzi is on the line from Lexington, Kentucky. Shotzi, can you make a quick point for us here on OnPoint?
Yeah, sure. My son is a senior in college studying computer science. And over the summer, he was just saying, Mom, you've got to buy this. You've got to do this. And really, I just did it because he wanted me to, and it meant a lot to him. But since last summer, my investment has quadrupled. And I can't actually say I understand exactly how it works. And I really didn't, I didn't expect anything, but it's gone through the roof.
And so you're pretty happy with that he did that.
Well, I'm cautious and I'm skeptical. Yep. And really, I just did it because it meant a lot to him. And I'm really surprised it's worked out so well.
Thank you, Shotzi. Final thought from you, Nathaniel Popper.
Well, I think that it is one of the most important things to remember about this is that, like all money, it is about crowd psychology. It is about faith. It's about people thinking it's going to be worth something. The dollar isn't backed by anything other than the government's promise to take it. Bitcoin, in a sense, isn't backed by anything other than this network. What it is backed by is this community of people who have come to believe in it. But one of the things you have to remember is that communities can lose faith in things as well. And I think that's the real risk. Is there something that leads people to lose faith? And that's the ultimate existential risk for Bitcoin or for any money.
Fascinating discussion. Nathaniel Popper covers finance and technology for The New York Times. Nathaniel, thanks much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Campbell Harvey, professor of finance at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. And thank you, Campbell.
Thanks, Tom.
You can continue this conversation, and you can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm sure that this is a discussion that can continue with some richness and depth online, so I hope you do join our conversation there. Meanwhile, coming up tomorrow, an upset victory in Alabama, a deal on the tax bill, subway bombing in New York, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.